Anatomy and Physiology, the Digestive System and Metabolism, Part 1. I like to start out with these summary slides, and this is one of those big picture slides. What are the two main parts of the digestive system? Number one, the main thing. The digestive system consists of a long tube that goes from the mouth to the anus, called the gastrointestinal tract, typically abbreviated the GI tract. There is a synonym I want you to know. I'm not big on synonyms, only when they're used in the real world. And the one I want you to know is that it's also called the alimentary canal. Let the root words help you. Alimentary refers to nutrition, so the alimentary canal is the nutrition canal. And in the real world, you'll see patients, real sick patients in the ICU, and they'll be on what's called hyperal, which is short for hyperalimentation. These are patients, again, usually in the ICU, they're very sick patients, and they have the weirdest IV bags hanging up. One of the bags, at least when I went to school, looked like a bag of milk. The other bag looked like a bag of lemonade or a bag of urine or something like that. And if you see that bag of milk and bag of lemonade, that means they're receiving nutrition through the vein called hyperalimentation. And they're usually, again, very sick patients. That's why I want you to know the synonym. Then there's a series of organs called accessory digestive organs. We've used that term before in anatomy. Accessory things are things that help the main thing. In this case, the six things on the list you see below, including the tongue, teeth, salivary glands, pancreas, liver, and gallbladder, are things that generally produce secretions that empty into the GI tract. In other words, most of the things on this list will shoot some kind of juice into the tube to allow the food to get better digested and absorbed along its way down the GI tract. Now, I'm going to affectionately refer to the GI tract as the food chute during this section because I don't feel like saying gastrointestinal tract 10 million times. Let's go ahead and do now another big picture slide. The main functions of the digestive system. There are two, digestion and absorption. And I've asked students to define these before on essay questions. So please be ready for this. What is digestion? Digestion is the mechanical and, underline, highlight, whatever you want to do, the word and, chemical breakdown of food into small molecules. Look at the equation from below. Earlier in A&P, you probably did this equation to the right. You built proteins out of amino acids. You built triglycerides out of fatty acids. You built more complex carbohydrates out of simple sugars through a process called dehydration synthesis. Well, now we're going the other way. We're going to go to the left in this equation. I put a box, a red box around the word hydrolysis because now we're going to take the food we eat, the proteins, the fats, and the carbs, and we're going to add water and dissolve them. And that's what the word hydrolysis means. Hydro means water. Lysis means to break apart. So we're going to add water to our food. And one more thing, write it down here, digestive enzymes. Water plus digestive enzymes added to our food results in chemical digestion of our food. So now we're going to break our carbs, lipids, and proteins down into our monosaccharides, our fatty acids, and our amino acids. So that what? So that we can absorb them. Absorption means passage of those small molecules through the lining of the gut wall and into our system. What does that mean? If mama says, absorb our food into our system, you took A&P, explain that to me. getting the food into our system means getting those food molecules either into our blood vessels, where most of our nutrients go, or into our lymph vessels, shown in green, which you remember are where our large fats or triglycerides get absorbed. So when your food is in your system, that means it gets absorbed into your blood and or lymph vessels. Big picture on this slide is, as we study the food chute from the mouth to the anus, you should ask yourself and be able to answer to yourself, what is happening in that part of the tube as far as digestion, both mechanical and chemical, if any? What is happening in that part of the food chute as far as absorption, if any? You should be able to know that for each part of the tube that we cover. These next two slides are just summary slides. These are meant for you to go back to at the very end of this PowerPoint and say to yourself, yes, I understand the basic bullet point key functions of each part of the digestive system. So take a look at this slide and its companion slide for a quick but good summary of the purposes of the main parts of the food chute. Of course, we're going to break it down in great detail one at a time. This picture I just threw in for a wow factor. Here is a cadaver specimen of a human being. And the weird thing is it kind of looks like the cat that you're dissecting in lab, doesn't it? You may want to refer back to this later. The basic layers of the GI tract. This is nitty-gritty kind of a stuff and rote memorization stuff. I know you're doing it in the lab because the lab is a co-requisite with the lecture, so I'm not going to do this in great detail. So you know there are four basic layers of the gut wall. You know there are three sub-layers. Very briefly, I'll break it down, but I'm really reserving this for your lab studies. Beginning with the opening in the food chute, the name for the opening in almost any hollow or tubular organ in anatomy is the lumen. That's a general principle. Like in blood vessels, you may have learned the opening in the blood vessel is the lumen. Then, the first basic layer of the gut wall, the innermost layer, is the mucosa. And you probably know that mucosa lines things. Then comes the layer beneath the mucosa that some genius called the submucosa. Then comes our big muscle layer with a lot of muscle in it called the muscularis. And finally, the shiny thin outer covering that we generally call the serosa. Then for your studying pleasure, someone has further divided the mucosa into three subdivisions. And they are, from the inside out, the all-important epithelial layer, then the lamina propria, the little layer in the middle, then the third layer of the mucosa is the muscularis mucosae, which tells you it's a little bit of muscle in the mucosa. So what's the big picture, first of all? The big picture is, as we study the food chute from the top to the bottom, you should say to yourself, are the layers there? And the answer is yes, the layers are there. Then you should look at what's different about that layer as far as its structure that gives it its special function. Because the structure of the stomach is different than the structure of the colon. The function of the stomach is different than the function of the colon. You should look at the differences in the structures of these layers because they will dictate the function in those layers. That's the big picture. Some of you are still saying, well, I don't care. I'll memorize the four basic layers and the three sublayers, but I'll never see it again. And I'll give you an example of how you would actually be wrong on that. Colorectal cancer, one of the biggest kinds of cancers that we see. It's a big killer in this country. We try to detect it early to save lives. But how do they give the patient the prognosis, and how do they decide on the treatment? It's all based on knowing the layers. I would like for you in your free time to Google how do you stage or grade and treat colon cancer. And up in those articles will come all these layers we're talking about. Because cancers, carcinomas essentially almost always start from epithelial cells. And as they grow, for example, in the colon, let's say, they slowly but surely penetrate their way out deeper and deeper through the wall and eventually could punch all the way out through the serosa. And as you can imagine, when they do their surgical specimen and they grade the cancer, the deeper it penetrates through the wall, the worse the prognosis, unfortunately, for the patient, and the more aggressive the treatment. I mean, if you ever wondered why somebody gets chemo and or x-ray therapy and or surgical therapy, it's based on the staging and the grading of the cancer. So yes, this is real life important stuff. Just a little bit of basics here. As we do each organ in the food chute, we'll get more specific. But here's some examples of things you should be looking for as we progress on. In the mucosa, the innermost layer, the all-important layer called the epithelium, you will notice in some parts of the food chute, it will be non-keratinized, stratified, squamous. Look where it is, the mouth, the throat, the esophagus, and then again in the anal canal. In English, if I'm you, I'm writing off to the side. It's at the top of the food chute and the bottom of the food chute. Why? The design matches the purpose. I mean, why do you have stratified squamous in your skin? It's for protection. And where's your food the hardest? I mean, when you eat some fish or chicken, there might be a little bone in that when you first start chewing that. It's nice to have that stratified squamous at the top of the food chute to protect you. The food, so to speak, will get hard again at the bottom. It's really not food anymore. It's called feces. But you'll see in your elderly dehydrated patients, the fecal matter can get rock hard, and that could tear the mucosa. So thank goodness there's stratified squamous at the top and the bottom of the food chute to protect us. Everywhere else, though, there are columnar epithelial cells. Columnar epithelial cells have many different functions. They can secrete digestive enzymes. They can absorb nutrients. Some of them are goblet cells, which produce mucus. And you should know the main function of mucus is to lubricate and protect. It protects your gut wall and also helps the food to slip slide down the chute. Then one of the all-important cells are called enteroendocrine cells. That means gut hormone cells. Yep, they make hormones, which after they're secreted in the blood, they reach their target organs, and we're going to find out that our gut hormone cells make chemicals that control the entire digestive process. Hormones, combined with nerves, control everything inside your body. In the mucosa, we also have this little layer in the middle called the lamina propria. Lamina means layer, like if you laminate a license, you put a layer of plastic on it. Propria means property of, if you care. I'm not really sure how that Greek root word helps me here. I just remember the lamina propria is the little layer in the middle. All that's in there is a little bit of connective tissue, some vessels, and some lymphatic tissue with double stars. Right here, right now, some wheels should be turning, and I want everyone to write down that this is our old friend, malt tissue. Remember, mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue, lymphocytes in our mucous membranes ready to fight off maybe some microbes that we swallowed so we don't get sick. So it's nice to connect the dots during the course. It really helps with long-term understanding and retention. The third layer of the mucosa is the muscularis mucosa. It is what it says it is and where it is. It's a thin layer of smooth muscle in the mucosae. It helps to kind of fold up the wall of the mucosa. That increases surface area, and as we'll study later, increasing surface area of an organ increases the efficiency and the amount of work that it could do. The submucosa, don't have a whole lot to say about it. Here it is underneath the mucosa. It's kind of the same old everywhere. Connective tissue, vessels, nerves, glands, and again, lymphatic tissue with double stars. This is also included with malt, so pencil that in case you're asked again. There are some nerves that are in this area called the submucosal plexus. That's just a network of nerves in the submucosa. Their purpose is to supply the mucosa. So in other words, they innervate the muscle and the glands in the mucosa. Briefly here on the muscularis, because we'll hit this in detail as we do each segment of the food chute. There's skeletal muscle in some places. Skeletal muscle, you'll remember, is voluntary muscle. And where do you have voluntary control of passage of food? Only two places. At the top, when you swallow, and at the bottom, when you defecate. So you know, really, without looking, where you have skeletal muscle. And it's interesting that those are basically the same places also where we had stratified squamous epithelium, isn't it? But everywhere else in the food chute with four stars, it's smooth muscle. Because pretty much, other than swallowing and defecating, things are under cruise control between, you know, the mouth and the anus. And the smooth muscle, what we call, mixes, crushes, and propels the food along by a series of rhythmic muscular contractions given the name peristalsis. Most of the muscularis is generally two layers. On the outside, longwise arranged fibers, and on the inside are circularly arranged smooth muscle fibers. There's a mnemonic for memorizing that. It's called loci, L-O-C-I. It's really a word. So that will help you remember longitudinal outer fibers and circular inner smooth muscle fibers. There's another plexus or network of nerves here called the myenteric plexus. I love the name. Myo means muscle. Enteric means guts. So these are the nerves that go to the big muscles of your guts. Not a whole lot to say about the serosa here. It's sort of a slippery, shiny layer that covers our organs in our abdominal pelvic cavities. It covers the cavity walls as well. You might remember when you studied epithelial membranes that serosa in general refers to something that covers cavities and organs that do not open to the outside of the body, as opposed to mucosa. Like in your mouth, there's a mucosa that is open to the outside of the body. What is it basically? It's a thin, shiny layer of connective tissue covered with simple squamous epithelium, secretes a little bit of slippery fluid, and it looks like somebody laid down a little piece of shrink wrap or saran wrap on the guts. If you look in the cat or if you look on that gross anatomy photo I kind of started with, you see that shiny covering. That's the serosa. Unfortunately, somebody, not me, I'm just the messenger, decided to give another name, a synonym for the serosa in the abdominopelvic cavity. In other words, below the diaphragm, everybody calls the serosa the peritoneum. So if I'm out with my friends on the weekend, we all call it the peritoneum. And there's two divisions of the peritoneum. The peritoneum that lines the walls of the abdominopelvic cavity is called the parietal peritoneum. Let the root words help you. Parietal means the outer walls or sides of something, like the parietal bones were the outer walls or sides of your head. Then there's the peritoneum that actually covers the guts, the organs themselves. That's called the visceral peritoneum. Let your root words help you. Visceral means guts, like if you eviscerate a deer. If you're a deer hunter, that means you took the guts out. I have a different way to remember it because I don't hunt deer. But I know if I'm in a long layover in the airport, I go to the bookstore. And I go there and I usually get some of the romance novels out, like the Harlequin romances. I'm sure I'm not the only one reading them. But in any case, there's often a story about somebody being dumped, like Betty dumped Johnny, and Johnny was left with a deep visceral pain. You know what I mean? Have you ever been dumped? I know it's not just me. So you've had that deep ache like in your gut after you've been dumped. That is called a visceral pain. So maybe another way for you to remember it. In between the two layers of peritoneum is a cavity that some genius called the peritoneal cavity. and there's a fluid in the cavity, a type of a watery or serous fluid called, yes, you guessed it, the peritoneal fluid. That if it gets infected by like a bursted appendix, we will call that a peritonitis. It ain't rocket science, guys, or I wouldn't do it. And you've seen this setup before. I mean, around the heart, there's a parietal and a visceral layer. Around the lungs, there's a parietal and a visceral layer with a cavity in between, with a fluid in between. It's a recurrent theme in anatomy. There are two special folds of peritoneum I'm going to focus on. One of them is called the greater omentum. Greater means big, and it is big. Omentum means fatty apron. It does look like a big fatty apron. If anybody asks you, it's the largest fold of peritoneum. It drapes down from the stomach, then loops back up to the colon, and it covers the internal organs. It has a lot of lymph nodes in it, and you know that's to help fight infection. Also, got to bring something up here just for fun. You know, our fat cells in our body have an unlimited capacity to store excess calories as fat. That's why if I keep eating pizza, I can grow to 500 pounds, 600, 900 pounds. And as it turns out, your patients on the weekends who selectively have too many calories from beer, they tend to be deposited in the fat cells of the greater omentum. That gives those men that nice, rounded, pregnant appearance. And you guessed it, the greater omentum is the source of the beer belly. Now, that's not a question on the test. That's just Trivial Pursuit. But at least you'll learn one useful thing today. The greater omentum is the beer belly. The other fold of peritoneum I want to talk about is the lesser omentum. It hangs up from the stomach. Actually, it hangs up from what we call the lesser curvature of the stomach, and it goes up to the liver. So it goes from lesser curve of the stomach to the liver. And if in the cat lab, if you try to grab the stomach and pull it out, you'll notice that you can't do it. And don't rip it, by the way. But if you tug on it, you'll see the liver is going to want to come with it. They're hooked together by the lesser omentum. And you must know there's lots of goodies in the lesser omentum, including blood vessels and also a bile duct. So in surgery, you don't want to goof up the lesser omentum or you will really mess that patient up. We'll move on now to our first part of the food chute. Let's talk about the mouth. Look, your A&P students, I don't think I'm going to have to tell you too much here. It is also called the oral cavity or the buccal cavity. Throw those synonyms out because they're used in the real world and in the dental program. I hope I don't have to point out to you the lips and the cheeks, but here's lips and cheeks. There's also a space between the lips and the cheeks and the teeth and the gingivae. This space that my arrow is in now is called the vestibule. Remember, all vestibule means is a space. There's lots of vestibules in the body, and this is one. This is the space, for example, if you're having a hard time picturing this, where like peanut butter gets stuck. Or if you know people who do dip or chew or whatever they call that stuff, you know, where they put the plug, the wad of chewing tobacco, they put it between their cheek and their gums, they're putting it in the vestibule. By the way, your patient shouldn't do that because that is bad for you. Also notice I have double stars here next to the word gingivae. I hope you all know what gingivae really mean. In English, that refers to your gums. So if someone has a gum infection, you call it a gingivitis. Please don't call it a gumitis because they'll wonder where you took your course from. Next part of the mouth, called the fauces. It tends to freak some students out, but look, here's the deal. The fauces is where this double-headed arrow is on this figure to the right. It's where this solid black line is on the figure to your left. Somebody just made this up. They said, look, we got to decide where the oral cavity stops and where the throat starts. And whoever invented it said, I decide it will be right here. And they named the dividing line between the mouth and the throat, the fauces. And that's all it is. So don't let it freak you out. The floor of the mouth is the tongue, and the roof of the mouth is the hard palate, the soft palate, and this little finger hanging down that you probably already know is called the uvula. Okay. While you're making notes, I got to tell you, I've always been jealous of my friends who went into dentistry. You know, because if something's wrong with somebody's teeth, whose fault is it? It's almost always the patient's fault, right? So they get off the hook a lot as far as malpractice. I noticed when I first went to see my dentist years ago, he'd poke around in my mouth for like, you know, 5 seconds, say, hey, looks good, $90, see you later. But then in the past few years, my dentist put a glove on and he's sweeping his finger all around in my vestibule, all underneath my tongue and all the top and bottom and sides. He's in there for like a half an hour feeling around. Now, is something wrong with my dentist? Maybe. But what's he checking for that can come back to bite him? They're checking for mouth or oral cancer, because if, as a healthcare provider, you miss oral cancer, that's going to come back and get you. Very tough cancer to treat, very disfiguring. If you search some images on the internet, you'll see what I'm talking about. You want to catch it and treat it early, please. And that's another reason for your patients not to use tobacco products. A little bit more on the mouth. Already we touched on this muscular process hanging down off the soft palate called the uvula. We also have a small fold of a mucous membrane that holds the tongue to the floor of the mouth. It is called the lingual frenulum. Lingual means tongue or language. Frenulum, I think, means like a bridle. And I guess a bridle holds a horse back. I don't know. I don't have a horse. But anyway, the lingual frenulum holds the tongue back down to the floor of the mouth. Some people will be born with an extra short, thick, tight one of these, and they can't talk right. It's called tongue-tied. There's a technical name for it you don't have to know. It's called ankyloglossia. But the treatment is you just snip it with a pair of scissors, and they're good to go. The tongue, I don't have a whole lot to say about. It's basically a big wad of skeletal muscle covered by a mucous membrane. I've read on the internet and in certain books that pound for pound, the skeletal muscle and the tongue is supposed to be the strongest muscle in the human body. I don't know if that's really true or not, but supposedly that's a little bit of Trivial Pursuit for you. I don't know if that means you know, people can do push-ups with it or anything like that. But anyway, it's trivia at best. Is the tongue attached? Of course it's attached to several bones of your body. The one I want you to know is the obvious one. It's attached to your lower jawbone called the mandible. So I'll ask you, can you swallow your tongue? I mean, really, like swallow your tongue down like into your stomach? No. It can fold back. It can go backwards and block your throat off, and patients can choke, but you can't really swallow your tongue. Now we move on to another accessory digestive organ called our teeth. Dentition just means a set of teeth. So write that down. Dentition is a set of teeth. We have two sets of teeth, or two dentitions. One set of teeth shown to your left, lots of names for it. I call them either primary teeth or baby teeth. Some people call them milk teeth or deciduous teeth. You can use whatever correct name you wish. But all I want you to know is they are 20 teeth that start to erupt at about 6 months of age. If you have babies, you know exactly what I mean. I have 4 children. Few of them are good with teething. The last one, not good with teething. Whenever a tooth came through, screaming, crying, everybody up all night. I'm putting, Orajel, I'm rubbing all over there. I'm dumping, bottles of teething tabs in there. Motrin, Tylenol, Benadryl, whatever it takes. By the way, I'm only kidding. I'm just saying, if you have kids, you know what I'm talking about, these baby teeth erupting. Our second set of teeth, the dentitions, we are going to call permanent teeth. Some people call them secondary teeth. You have to know that we have 32 of them that start erupting roughly at about 6 years of age. I'm going to show you the teeth using the top as an example. The bottom teeth match it. And let me start in the front. on the top front, we have these four teeth called incisors. They kind of have the sharp edge on them. You know, they're like the chomper teeth in the front. Then let me run down just one side of this diagram because it's symmetric. The next tooth next to the incisor is called either the canines or the cuspids. Those are the ones that are sharp, that kind of look like a, you know, fang teeth, or you guys are into those vampire movies, you know, maybe people call them the vampire teeth. There is a slang word for them. People in the old days used to call them the eye teeth. So there's your canines. Then we have two premolars. Then running down this right side of the diagram, we have three molars. And it's symmetric all the way around. And yeah, if you do the math, it comes out to 32 teeth. I do want you to know the name for the last molar that comes in. Maybe it might not come in until you're 20 years old or so. That last molar to come in is called the wisdom tooth. It often gets impacted. It can't get out. Many people have to have their wisdom teeth extracted. I had to have mine taken out. It was decades ago. Didn't have all the fancy drugs you have now. And believe it or not, to take my wisdom teeth out in the office, the doctors back then gave me sodium pentothal. I don't know if you guys know what that is, but it's truth serum. It's what the CIA gives to people when they interrogate them. Goodness knows what was coming out of my mouth when I was given truth serum. In any case, your book goes off a little bit too far here as far as I'm concerned. Your book says each structure has a different function. Since your incisors are sharp edge that cut your food, since your canines are pointy like a fang that's to tear your food, and your molars have surfaces that are adapted to grind and crush your food. But I mean, really, do you put a piece of food into your mouth and think, well, let me cut it with my incisor, then I'll tear it with my canine, then I crush it with my molar? No. We just put the food in our mouth and we eat it. So let's just leave it at this on this slide. We'll dive into some basic structures of the tooth. This slide's fairly straightforward. The part of the tooth above the gum line, we call it the crown. The part of the tooth just below the gum line, we call it the neck. Then the part of the tooth that is rooted into the bony socket, we call that, you guessed it, the root. Now comes a slide that I like to ask, not just a lot of questions on, but just really, I think, more important information. What are the components of our teeth? Number one, on top of the crown, shown here in white, is the enamel. You should know it's the hardest substance in the human body. I've asked it 1,000 times on test. Yes, it's even harder than bone. Why? Because it has the highest concentration of calcium salts in the body. We'll see, though, that the enamel is not invincible. It has an enemy we'll talk about shortly. The next component of tooth, shown here in sort of a tannish, yellowish deal, is called dentin. It's also calcified. It's also hard. It's not as hard as the enamel. But if I ask you, it's the major internal component of the tooth. In other words, if I ground up the tooth and put all the different pieces into separate dishes, what would make up most of the tooth? You would say dentin. And that's easy for me to remember. Why? Root word dens means tooth, like dentist, dental. So I remember the tooth, which in Greek is dens, is mostly made up of dentin. Dentin means tooth, and the tooth is mostly made up of dentin. Next we have the pulp. The pulp is just this junk, like pulp in orange juice. It's just the junk in the orange juice. It contains connective tissue, blood vessels, and nerves with a star, by the way. The pulp is contained in a cavity that some genius called the pulp cavity. And then I want you to pay attention to these narrow extensions of the pulp cavity that go down into the roots, and those are called the root canals. Couple things I want to talk about on this slide. Number one, when you go to the dentist, get, you know, your teeth worked on, and they maybe have to do some cavity work, where does it hurt when they start to drill? Does the enamel hurt that much? No, not really. When they get to the dentin, well, yeah, you start to feel it. If they get into that pulp cavity and hit the nerves, oh yeah, you're jumping out of the chair. That's why mostly what they do, of course, is give you the injection. They numb the proper part of the trigeminal nerve and get you all numbed up. Personally, I hate needles. I didn't mind giving them, but I don't like getting them. It makes me want to almost pass out. So when I go to the doctor, it's just drill, baby, drill. No needles for me. For some reason, that drill just doesn't bother me. I know some of you are laughing, but I bet there's someone else listening who doesn't get the needle either. Also on this slide, it reminds me again how jealous I am of my dentist friends. You know, if you ever went for a root canal, you know, they do the root canal, and they put on a temporary crown after they're done. Of course, they charge a big bucks for that. And then you got to come back later, right, for the permanent crown, and that's more big bucks. I'm telling you, the dentist, they got it made. Anybody detecting a little bit of jealousy here? Next on this slide, we have this white structure lining the roots. It is called cementum. It is also bone-like. It's calcified. And I love the term because it sounds like cement. And the cement cements the root into the bony socket. So it's easy for me to remember that. It needs a little bit of help, though. Look here at the cementum covering the root. And then we have these tiny white ligaments going from the cementum to the bony jaw. Those ligaments are called periodontal ligaments with triple stars, because you'll see people with periodontal disease. And that will loosen up the ligaments. And what happens? You can tell me right now. The tooth will loosen up and it could fall out. And that's what happens in bad periodontal disease. Our next accessory digestive organs are called the major salivary glands. There are three pairs of major salivary glands. First, shown on this slide, right near the ear and on top of the masseter muscle, is the parotid gland. And I love that name. Para means near, oto means ear. These are the near-the-ear glands. They are exactly where they say they are. Next comes the submandibular glands. Guess where they're located? Exactly where the name tells you. They're underneath, tucked in, underneath and inside the mandible. Third pair of glands are the sublingual glands, and by the root words alone, you know they're located under the tongue in the floor of the mouth. Each of these glands has ducts that carry the saliva into the oral cavity. Here's the parotid duct shown nicely running from the parotid gland over the masseter muscle and into an opening in the mouth. This always reminds me of little Mikey in the third grade. You know, little Mikey, he always figured out how to manipulate the system. He figured out a way to squeeze his cheek muscles just right, where he would apply pressure to his salivary glands and then be able to eject under rather high velocity saliva out these ducts and out of his mouth. Some kids in class told me there's actually a name for that. I think they said it's called gleeking or something like that. I never heard that term before. But it's where the kid learns how to shoot the spit out of his mouth. Now, don't do it. That's gross. It's just funny that there's always that little Mikey in the third grade. Little bit of histology on this slide, but to tell you the truth, this is mostly for lab. If you slice open a salivary gland and slap it on a slide, what does it look like? Notice the cells are arranged in clusters. The name for a cluster in anatomy is an acinus, A-C-I-N-U-S. Plural is acini. Don't be afraid to say it. There are two types of cells. In those acini, there are serous cells that make the watery part of our spit, including some special juice that we'll talk about called salivary amylase, a very important enzyme. And there's a general principle on this slide. Serous means watery. I mean, if you're a nurse changing dressings on patients, you're going to have to describe the drainage on your chart note and the doctor's going to look at it. If it's pussy, you're going to say a purulent drainage, and the doctor will diagnose and treat an infection. If it's a bloody drainage, you will describe it as a sanguineous drainage, and your doctor will know that, of course, the patient might need some a cautery or some additional treatment to stop the bleeding. If it is a watery, kind of a clear straw-colored fluid that we're all familiar with seeing on our Band-Aids, that is called a serous drainage. And that's pretty normal to see a little bit of serous drainage, by the way, coming out of a wound. The point is, serous means watery. Then there are mucus cells, and you guessed it, mucus cells make the mucus. Mucus is to lubricate and protect in the human body. Now comes one of my favorite slides. It's an important slide, not just for the test, but for real life. What makes up saliva and what's the function? Some of you are freaking out. You're saying, man, there's eight things on this slide. But just calm down, because look at the four bullet points above my pointer. That's just common sense. You already know saliva is almost all water, which helps dissolve your food for tasting. You know it moistens your food and makes it easier to swallow. You know mucus lubricates and protects. And you know that saliva protects your mouth from infection by its rinsing action. So those four bullet points are common sense. You couldn't possibly miss them. The key goodies are on the bottom. There are four key ingredients of the saliva I want you to know. Number one, our old friend bicarbonate ions. Remember those? Their function was as a buffer. It's beautiful to have a buffer called bicarbonate in the mouth. Because earlier I told you enamel was the hardest substance in the human body, but it has an enemy. It has an Achilles heel, and that is acid. Acid can cause damage to the enamel. For example, your bulimic patients, what do? They vomit, and the strong hydrochloric acid from the stomach can severely damage the enamel. Your alcoholic patients, they tend to throw up a lot too, and they will have bad teeth. Trust me, you'll see them. Then I'd like to ask you a question. So what causes cavities? Does the sugar in your mouth directly eat a hole in your teeth? Do the bacteria in your mouth directly Pac-Man or munch little holes in your enamel? Or is it something else? And the answer is something else. The bacteria metabolize the sugar, and the sugar produce acids like lactic acid as a byproduct, and it's the acid that makes the cavity. The next ingredient in saliva I want you to know is the enzyme that's in almost all body fluids that we talked about already, called lysozyme. It's in breast milk. It's in tears. It's in gastrointestinal secretions. You gotta know it. The next ingredient is an antibody. If I ask you for the name of the antibody that is in almost all body fluids, like saliva, you will say IgA. Remember, A for almost all body fluids. Finally, the other key ingredient is salivary amylase, because chemical digestion of starches, that's like potatoes and pastas, begins in the mouth with salivary amylase. So what makes us salivate and what makes us not salivate? Well, on the top are the things that increase salivation. You see it, you smell food, you hear bacon crackling on the stove, you think of grandma's cooking, you feel the food on your tongue or you taste it. It starts you salivating. I'm thinking of my grandma's cooking right now, and I'm salivating right now. Which division of my autonomic nervous system made me do that? You should know it, right? It's the rest and digest division, called the parasympathetic. Pencil it in on the slide. What causes us to have decreased salivation? Well, stress, right? People are all stressed out. What's that division of the ANS? That's the scared division. Remember, that's the sympathetic division. You may have noticed speakers, public speakers, if they're real nervous and scared, their mouth dries out and they always have to reach for that glass of water on the table, right? Other things dry our mouth out: dehydration, age, certain drugs we take, and so forth, some diseases as well that you'll learn about. And you might be saying, well, so what? Well, if someone has really bad saliva, what's going to be the condition of their teeth based on your knowledge of the last slide? it's going to be bad, right? I mean, they're going to have horrible teeth. Bad saliva equals bad teeth. Best example I can give you is meth mouth. You'll see a lot of it here in our area of the country in the emergency room. And people with meth mouth have some of the worst teeth you'll ever see. I mean, their teeth look black from the severe damage to their enamel. And they sort of have a triple whammy, I guess. The methamphetamine itself, the drug, is a sympathetic kind of a drug. So that dries them out just from that. Then, of course, they're not taking care of themselves, right? I mean, after all, they're doing drugs. So they don't tend to be very well hydrated. So the dehydration makes it worse. And on top of that, what they do to cover up the horrible smell in their mouth is they tend to drink a lot of cheap sugary drinks like Kool-Aid or whatever. So now they're dumping sugar in a mouth with like terrible saliva. So they pour gas on the fire. Trust me, once you see your first case of meth mouth in Bay County, you won't forget it. Here is a key slide. Remember, as we go through the food chute from the top to the bottom, you're supposed to say to yourself, what is happening in the food chute as far as digestion and absorption? So here we go. What's happening in the mouth as far as digestion? Is there mechanical digestion going on? You bet there is. It's called mastication. You better say it right, you better spell it right, or they'll wonder where you took your anatomy course. Because all mastication means is chewing. When you chew your food, you mechanically digest it, you break it into pieces, you mix it with your saliva to form a wad called a bolus with a star. All a bolus means is a lump of something. In this case, it's a lump of food and saliva. In the hospital, you'll be asked to deliver a bolus of IV fluid. That means you'll be asked to deliver rapidly a wad of IV solution, maybe with a medication in it, to a patient. So that's the importance of knowing a bolus. Is there any chemical digestion in the mouth? The answer you will say is yes. We already briefly mentioned starch digestion begins in the mouth. Potatoes and pastas and such begin with the enzyme called salivary amylase. Does any absorption happen in the mouth? I used to tell students this. No absorption of food happens in the mouth. And for my course, that is correct. No significant absorption of any nutrients occurs in the mouth. But then one smart girl one year raised her hand and said, Dr. Gonshore, what about some drugs? And she's right. There are some drugs you'll give. I bet you can think of one right now, like sublingual nitroglycerin tablets that you'll give to patients with chest pain. Yeah, some drugs do get absorbed through the mucosa of the mouth. While you're making some notes here, I want to give an example that those of you with children probably will never forget that will help some of this stuff sink in. You know, you go to feed your little baby the jar of that mushy baby food, right? Sometimes you go to feed the baby, you pull the spoon out, and the baby's just kind of like bobbing and weaving and ducking, and you just can't get the spoon in the baby's mouth, and you just give up because it's worthless at that point in time. So you'll put the cap back on the jar and put it in the fridge. Sometimes you go to feed the baby. The baby will take a couple of spoonfuls, decide they're full or they don't want any more, and you'll put the cap back on the jar and put it in the fridge. You know, because you might could use it the next day. So the next day you open the fridge, and you open the jar of baby food where the baby never tasted it. In other words, the spoon never went in his mouth or in the jar. What does the baby food look like? It looks just like normal mushy baby food. What about if you open the jar of baby food that the spoon went in and out of the baby's mouth and jar a couple of times? What does it look like? It looks all liquefied, doesn't it? Well, one of the reasons is because some of those enzymes are starting to digest the starches in that baby food and are liquefying the food. And that will make this point maybe stick a little bit better. Next comes the pharynx. The pharynx in English is the throat. You should have already studied that in detail in earlier A&P units. But a brief summary here. Look, the pharynx is just a boring skeletal muscular tube lined by a mucous membrane. It is funnel-shaped. it goes from the back of the nose called the internal nares. All the internal nares means is the inside back of your nose. And from the back of your nose, it extends inferiorly to where it reaches sort of a fork in the road. One fork goes posteriorly, that's called the esophagus. One fork goes anteriorly, that's called the larynx. You should know the pharynx is divided into three general regions. The part of the throat behind the nose is called the nasopharynx. The part of the throat behind the mouth is called the oropharynx. And the part of the throat behind the larynx is called the laryngopharynx. Again, just a boring skeletal muscular tube. Purpose only one, transport with a star. But what does the throat transport? Don't miss it on the test. Here's the question. Does the pharynx transport food only, air only, or both? And the answer is both. Because the throat can carry food back to the esophagus or air anteriorly to the larynx. No better time than now to talk about deglutition. Deglutition in English means swallowing, and that's one of those great fill-in-the-blank type questions. I'll make it short and sweet. I'll really condense the way your book did it. The first part of swallowing is the only part that is voluntary. In your figure from your book, it's showing the big muscular tongue pushing the bolus, the wad of food, back into your oropharynx. That's the only part you control. When you take that swallow and you go, like that, I mean, you did that on purpose. It's voluntary. But after that, that bolus stimulates sensory nerves in the back of your throat that we studied already in the brain section. Those signals go to the brainstem, and through a complicated series of neuromuscular events, that causes the soft palate and the uvula to elevate to block off your nose, and it causes the larynx to lift. Notice when you first swallow, if you look in the mirror, your larynx goes up. And when the larynx goes up, the epiglottis flaps over the glottis. So then food can't go down the airways. So if this all works properly, food can only go one direction, down the food chute. But it doesn't always work like this. This is a really complicated symphony of events. And that's why sometimes, you know, we all have food go down the wrong pipe, so to speak. That's why you have to be careful with kids. You gradually advance them to different, you know, types and textures of foods. And then there was always little Mikey in the third grade. He learned how to manipulate the system, didn't he? He figured out how to make the milk from the milk carton bypass his soft palate and uvula, get into his nasal cavity, and he could shoot milk out of his nose. So now little Mikey, he learned ways to shoot milk out of his eyes, he learned ways to shoot milk out of his nose, and please tell me that I'm not the only one who had little Mikey like that in the third grade. Finally, I think we'll end this unit with the esophagus, the next part of the food chute. Here it is here going from the pharynx down to the stomach. Again, it's a boring, collapsible muscular tube. You must know it is located posterior to the windpipe, which is really called the trachea. Please know this anatomy. Many of you are going to be involved in rescuing patients during code blue. You're going to perform what's called an intubation. That means you're going to put a breathing tube in the patient. If you slip that breathing tube just a couple millimeters too far posteriorly, you're going to put it in the food chute instead of in the trachea. And then when you start to ventilate the patient with the breathing bag, called the AMBU bag, you're going to start to blow the patient's stomach up with air. And you're going to notice, by the way, not only is their stomach going to blow up, but they're going to start to turn bluer and bluer and bluer. I hope you figured it out before that, by the way. Because the next thing they're going to do is they're going to throw up on you. Then they vomit, out comes the acid from their stomach, and it goes down their airways into their lungs. That's bad. That's called an aspiration pneumonia, and people can die and have died from that. So you must know the anatomy. How does the esophagus get to the stomach? It punches through a hole in the diaphragm called the esophageal hiatus, which is spelled on the next slide. All a hiatus is in anatomy is an opening. I think in some countries when they go on vacation, they say they go on hiatus. That means there's an opening in their schedule, I guess. So you see the word hiatus in anatomy, it means an opening. I'll show you a beautiful picture I pulled from your muscle chapter. This is a patient laying on their back. You're looking on at their diaphragm from the top down. Here is the esophagus going through the esophageal hiatus on its way to the stomach. And it's on this slide where I want you to understand something called a hiatal hernia. Basic principle in anatomy. A hernia is where a part of your body is pooching into another part of your body where it doesn't belong. In the case of a hiatal hernia, it means part of your stomach is pooching up through this weak spot in your diaphragm called the esophageal hiatus, and it actually moves up into your chest cavity. So part of your stomach ends up in your thorax. That's what a hiatal hernia is. A little bit of histology of the esophagus. Remember, one of the things you're supposed to do as you study the food chute is you're supposed to look at the layers. Are the layers there? Of course they're there. But what's special about them that gives this organ its function? What makes it different, and what makes it also sort of out there for a test question? Well, let's take a look at the mucosa. Anything special there? Yup. Non-keratinized stratified squamous epithelium. We have it in our esophagus for protection. What about submucosa? Is there a submucosa? Of course there is. There always is. What's in there? Anything I could ask you about that's different? Nope. Same old, same old. Connective tissue, blood vessels, glands, same old junk. I can't even think of a question to ask you about it. What about the muscularis layer? Anything special there? Oh yeah, check it out. This is where we have the blend between skeletal muscle and smooth muscle. For the purposes of our course, let's assume that that changeover from skeletal to smooth muscle happens about midway down the esophagus. I mean, after all, I already mentioned that most of our guts is smooth muscle, but we do have skeletal muscle at the top of the bottom. Some places got to blend together, and this is the place, if anyone asks you. Last but not least, on an earlier slide, it was mentioned that the outer shiny covering on our guts is called the serosa. Everywhere except on the esophagus. Again, I'm just the messenger. I didn't make this up on purpose to give you something extra to study. The superficial thin connective tissue covering on the esophagus is called the adventitia. You should be seeing that in the lab as well. It's the shiny covering on the esophagus. What's its purpose? How does it work? Boring. It's just for transport. It really just, pushes the bolus of food down to your stomach. How does it do it? Through a series of nice, rhythmic, synchronized muscular contractions of the outer longitudinal and inner circular layers that propels the food down the chute by a process called peristalsis. P-E-R-I-S-T-A-L-S-I-S, peristalsis. How long does it take food to get down the esophagus? I don't care if you memorize this at all. I'm not going to ask you. Your book says 1 second for liquids, 4 to 8 seconds for solids. That's variable, of course, but we would all probably guess that liquids get there faster than solids. What happens when the bolus of food gets to the lower end of the esophagus? It reaches a sphincter called the lower esophageal sphincter. It is where and what it says it is, a sphincter at the lower end of the esophagus where it hooks up with the stomach. And as the bolus of food reaches that sphincter, the sphincter is supposed to open up and let that wad of food plop into your stomach. Then, if the lower esophageal sphincter fails to close properly after the food passes through it, you can have a problem. Because if you don't close what is typically abbreviated the LES, yes, you'll hear that term in the hospital, LES, for lower esophageal sphincter. If it does not close properly, acid from the stomach, very strong hydrochloric acid, will go backwards into the esophagus and cause what is known in slang as heartburn. The real name for that is GERD, which stands for gastroesophageal reflux disease. And I love that name because it tells you this is a disease where you're having reflux or backflow of gastric juice, stomach acid, into the esophagus. Well, what's the problem with that? The problem with that is if you burn the esophagus too much and too long from stomach acid, your patients are at much higher risk from a lethal form of cancer called esophageal cancer. That's why there are various forms of treatments. There are medical treatments for this, various drugs to treat it. There's a new treatment that a student just told me about the other day where they inject a synthetic foam into the LES that sort of thickens it and strengthens it. So there are procedures to try to treat this, all designed to try to prevent deadly esophageal cancer. Half the battle in anatomy is knowing where the parts are, guys. And I want to tell you a story that happened in the news. There was a famous actor, I guess I won't mention his name, but years ago, this actor went to the hospital, and he's a young guy at the time, and they diagnosed him with heartburn. They said, oh, you're a young guy, you got some chest pain. Oh, what's the chance of you having a heart attack or anything like that? We send you home on some antacids and you'll be good to go. He came back the next day dead on a stretcher. Why? Because, you know, they forgot to do their job. If someone comes to you with chest pain, you're supposed to figure it out. And your job as a healthcare provider is don't kill the patient. Anybody could treat the easy stuff. I mean, a cold will usually go away by itself. They rely on you to detect and treat the big things. So half the battle is just knowing what's there. I mean, what's in my chest? Well, there's muscles and bones. Maybe I have muscle strain. There's a heart in there. Even if I'm young, could I have a heart attack? You bet you I can. There's an esophagus in there. I could have heartburn. There's an aorta in there. I could have a bursting aorta. And that's exactly what happened to that actor. He ruptured an aortic aneurysm, sent out with heartburn. By the way, how do you tell the difference? You'll learn there's lots of tests. When someone comes in with chest pain, you're going to do lots of tests. One of the tests you're going to do that you can do real quick and it makes you feel good real quick is something called you give them a GI cocktail. Now, that's not a drink you can get like at a local bar. A GI cocktail is a mixture of antacids, acid blockers, and a drinkable form of lidocaine. It's a viscous or thick gelatinous lidocaine. Now, don't go drinking bottles of lidocaine, by the way, that you see on the shelf. That could actually kill you. Again, I want to emphasize, don't do anything I ever say to do in this course. Just know the material. But there is a drinkable form of lidocaine. And when we mix up this GI cocktail and give it to a patient with chest pain, if they instantly feel better, say, oh, that feels great. I feel like I'm good to go. That makes you feel a lot better that it's probably not something bad like a heart attack or a bursting aneurysm. It doesn't mean you don't do the test. You're still, waiting for your EKG results, your radiographic studies, your blood work, and all the other stuff because you still have to rule out the bad stuff. But it sure makes you feel better if they feel better after they drink the good old GI cocktail.